Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I don't think so. No. No, it is on. It's just not very loud. I was actually teaching an adult Sunday school class yesterday morning, and every one of the class members who went up to the microphone went, "Is this on? Is this on?" We decided it was the hearing of the attendees in the Sunday school class. It wasn't the volume of the PA system. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the dean at Perkins School of Theology, and I am thrilled to be able to join you here for this occasion. This luncheon today is an initial occasion to draw together members of the faith community and the business community for what we hope is going to be a series of thought-provoking discussions. And we are absolutely delighted not only that you have come to be here, but also that we are going to have the privilege of hearing from two very distinguished leaders, one in theological education, the other in the business community, both of whom are profoundly committed to the relationships between the business community and the theological community for the mission of the church. I specifically want to extend a welcome to you to this space. Some of you may know that we recently completed a building renovation, a new construction project. This room, the Great Hall in Elizabeth Perkins Prothero Hall, was part of the space that was dedicated on September 11th, 2009. And we are thrilled that this space is available for these kinds of public gatherings. There will be more appropriate introductions of the two individuals who are going to be speaking to all of us today. But I want, in particular, to express a word of gratitude to the two people whose generosity made this luncheon conversation possible. You and I are the guests of two very special people who have provided this day for us. And I want you to join me as I invite John Castle and Dodie Crockett to stand and be recognized with gratitude. As I said, my role as dean of Perkins School of Theology is to welcome you to this great occasion. And we are absolutely thrilled at the series of conversations linking the faith and business luncheon discussions together that we're about to unfold. This idea developed really as something that Dodie initiated in one of our committee meetings. And one thing led to another. And those of you who know and are privileged to work with Dodie understand that when Dodie gets an idea, it does not end at the idea discussion. She is famous for saying to me, "We don't leave a meeting until the action items are identified." When she proposed the idea, she took the steps to make it possible. So, on your behalf, I am deeply grateful to Dodie Crockett and to John Castle for their sponsorship of this event. I want to introduce to you a member of the Perkins staff, the Reverend Jeannie Trevino Tedley. She is director of the Mexican American Program and director of the Regional Course of Study for local pastors. She's a clergy member, ordained deacon in the Central Texas Conference of the United Methodist Church. Jeannie is going to offer our luncheon invocation.
Let us pray. Gracious and loving God, we give you thanks for this beautiful day. We know that all that we are and all that we have comes from you. We give you thanks for this opportunity that we have to gather together to talk about faith and business. And we give you thanks for the food that is before us. And we do remember that there are persons in our midst that do not have the food that we have before us. So we pray that as we eat this food, that it may nourish our bodies so that we may be your faithful servants, today and every day. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Start talking amongst yourselves and enjoy your meal.
Hello, Anna Claudia. How are you all? Well, if you all, is this mic on? You can hear? Okay, good. Huh? Okay. Let's go ahead and get started with our program. You all, please continue to enjoy your lunch. But we want to go ahead and get started so we have plenty of time for Don and Jamie to speak, and then to have a few minutes afterwards for your response and your comments. We're delighted each of you all are here, and welcome. This is a lovely space, and we're grateful for Perkins for hosting this event. I'm particularly delighted to have done so with Dodie. You know, as I think about this topic of faith and business, as I began to take my journey seriously, more seriously in the early 90s when I was at EDS, I begin to realize there is an inherent tension, it seems to me, between our faith and the work in our public life or in our business life. You know, our faith, our biblical teaching calls us to be faithful and love one another and blessed are the poor and the meek. And the rules of business seem somewhat contrary to that. We want to be successful in the business world. We want to compete and we want to win and we want to get ahead. And those aren't particularly biblical teachings. And so as you think about this topic, we know that there is a certain kind of tension. And so as Dean Lawrence said at the beginning, we're honored and blessed to have two wonderful people to come sort this complicated issue out for us. Don Williams will speak first. Don was educated at Abilene Christian University. He got his law degree at George Washington University. He practiced law for several years. Don and I practiced law together. Jamie was unkindly reminding me that the year Don and I were practicing law, she was born. Don then went on to Trammell Crowe and became CEO and chairman of the Trammell Crowe Company. All the while, he was very active in civic endeavors, and I won't mention all of those because they're too numerous. He was on several boards. He chaired the Citizens Council. Most recently, he chaired the Dallas Foundation. He retired from Trammell Crowe in the mid-90s, early 90s, and started his foundation for community empowerment that focused on low-income neighborhoods and people in less advantageous situations, particularly initially anyway in Fair Park and South Dallas. For his efforts, he won and was awarded the prestigious Lenz Award in 1998. Don has a heart for the gospel. He has a heart for the poor. He's a committed and faithful believer, and as Paul says, he's living a life worthy of the gospel. Dr. Jamie Clark Soles, she is a professor of New Testament here at Perkins. She was educated at Stetson, where she was awarded Phi Beta Kappa. She went to Yale, was awarded MDiv and a PhD at Yale University. Then came to Perkins. Her specialty is particularly the Gospel of John and the literature surrounding that. And she's got a new manuscript of a new book we were just talking about death and the afterlife, which we can all anticipate that book. She is widely published on a variety of topics, and she's a popular professor here, and we're delighted that she's here with us. And so Don will go first, then Jamie will speak, and then we'll look forward to your comments and your thoughts. So welcome, Don Williams.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. Is this – Peter, can you hear all right? This is working. You can hear, but you'd prefer not to? Okay. John, thank you for that generous introduction. It sort of reminded me like the old real estate days where developers balance sheet, you know, where it's perhaps exaggerating the assets and understating the liabilities. But thank you very much. I appreciate that. And to Bill Lawrence, I hope it's not a signal, but Bill had to leave early. I don't take it personally, JB, do you? I mean, you okay with that? Okay. But I appreciate particularly being out here at Perkins and the extraordinary contributions Perkins has made to this community. And to be specifically, several of the faculty members out here, like Jorg Rieger, is an example, have become friends. And a lot of his writings and teachings have informed my understanding of what it means to be trying to do the kind of work we're doing in the inner cities, how the Gospels really speak to that in a more direct way than I'd understood before. So I appreciate this opportunity to speak to the group. I feel a little bit like, if you remember, in one of Hardy's poems called The Darkling Thrush, you know, it's a cold, dreary day, although the sun did come out, a cold, dreary day, and it's quiet and someplace, and all of a sudden this thrush, which, you know, is a very common bird, it's not an uncommon bird, starts singing out in the middle of nowhere and startles everyone. And so I feel a little bit like that. He calls it flinging his soul on the growing gloom. So I think I'm that thrush today. So y'all bear with me here. What I'd like to do is sort of tell my story and how I've engaged in some of these issues of business and faith through that means. And then there will be opportunities to set the record correctly later with Jamie. And then Q&A periods. Jamie and I will be happy to try to do whatever. As John said, I practiced law for about 7 years and left law practice in May of 1973. And the first partners meeting we had at Trammell Crow Company was with Herman Kahn, then head of the Hudson Institute. And he talked about this booming economy that we were going into, how we were going into what he called a troisième belle époque. All the poor nations of the world and poor folk of the world would get rich, and all the rich nations would get richer. And boy, did I buy into that. And of course, as you all remember, in October 73, the Arab-Israeli War breaks out, the oil embargo. Oil goes from $2 to $4 a barrel, and people thought it was the end of the world. And there's a global recession and, of course, a real estate depression. So I thought I was going, you know, into economic glory land with Trammell Crow Company, and we were underwater right away. So here's the takeaway from this. Anywhere you see lawyers going, you should short that business. So right, John? EDS hadn't been the same. My first job with Trammell Crow Company was to head the international division. We were developing buildings in 9 foreign countries around the world. And shortly after I arrived there, we were losing money in 9 different currencies and legal systems. But I want to tell an incident that occurred during that period that I think shaped what the rest of what I would like to say today. We were Manufacturers Hanover Bank. Some of you in this room remember when there was a Manufacturers Hanover Bank in New York. It was an important banking relationship with us, and they asked me to come up one day to New York and said they owned 50% of a bank in Iran, and they wanted to build a new office building there and wanted us to be the developer of that. Would I develop a set of plans and, you know, a little model, a maquette, you know, and then go to Tehran, meet with the head of the bank, make the deal, and come back? So I had a few other stops on this trip. So I started by, you know, we got the plans. I had this little maquette with me. And Peter, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And went to South America. We were developing in several different cities in Brazil. And from there, I went to Paris. We were losing money on several office buildings in suburban Paris. And from there, it was clear in the mid-70s there was going to be a concentration of resources in the Middle East. So we were trying to do some business in the Middle East. And I went to Cairo. And from there to Beirut, and from there to Kuwait. And the last stop on this trip, carrying this little maquette the whole way, the last stop was in Tehran. And I went in to meet the head of the bank. He said, "Oh, great to see you." I showed him the plans, the maquette. He just loved the project. And I said, "Great. Let's talk about what kind of deal we can make in the joint venture." And he said, "What? We don't want any joint venture." Well, you know, I see this is a losing deal, so I'm trying to hang on this grasp for something. So well, can we be the construction? Now, we don't need a construction manager, you know, and all of that, but thank you very much. And so I said to him, "Well, the least you can do is introduce me to your rug dealer at the souk in Tehran and have him take me there and tell him to give me a good deal on a rug," which he did. So I exchanged this maquette for this small rug, not wanting to ship it. So I'm leaving. We get on Air Iran, taking off. War breaks out in Cyprus, so the Turks and the Greeks are going at it. Can't overfly Cyprus, so we had to go to Moscow. Cold War days, as you know, you couldn't leave the plane, so we sit out on the tarmac for 4 or 5 hours. And then finally we get released, get to London. I boarded a Pan Am flight, flew from there to JFK in New York. Now, this is 3 weeks, this whole trip, you know, lugging my little Persian rug, which I still have in my home today. And it was snowing in New York. It was a Friday night. We landed at the Pan Am terminal there. Many of you all remember that. I think it's Delta now. And remember how the little jitney buses would come around from terminal to terminal at JFK? Well, they weren't coming that night because of a snowstorm. So I take off running, trying to catch that last brand of flight to Dallas on a Friday night. And about halfway down that Pan Am terminal, I slipped on the ice and just spread-eagled down like this. And, you know, blood on my hands. I still have scars on my hands from that. And it was a moment of epiphany, really. You know, what on earth are you doing with your life? And I stopped, just prayed for a minute or two. I couldn't catch the last flight. And so I went into a hotel and spent the night studying the Bible and praying that somehow I needed to find more balance in my life. And came back to Dallas. And I would say that began for me a journey that's still ongoing, by the way. What does it mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to be this human being? So I want to tell you just briefly about that search for me. I'm an avid reader and enjoy reading very much and have benefited from it. And one of the people I enjoy reading the most is Frederick Buechner. In fact, there's a little handout at your place of just a couple of little extracts from Buechner. So I read most of Buechner's books and had the privilege to meet him and be in a seminar with him. And he said something that stuck with me and in a way has framed the way I've thought about life since. He said, you know, life is a search. And he said there are three great searches in life. The search for a person to be, the search for others to love, and the search for a work to do. So what I'd like to do is just frame my comments in those three categories. The search for a person to be. After that trip back from New York, I began to study the Bible again, which I hadn't done in a long time. Began to teach a Sunday school class, and that forces you to study because people are smart and they ask tough questions. And I think that began a process of how to resolve these kinds of tensions that John spoke about, tensions within ourselves. You know, how is it that we're made in the image of God and just a little lower than the angels? And, you know, the feet of clay, or as the Apostle Paul says, you know, that we do the things we don't want to do and we don't do the things that we know we should do. So we start with that internal tension. So I think the tension we experience in business bears out of the internal tensions of identifying and finding what it means to be a human being. So for me, I think that is still a work in process, even though that began some 35 years ago. And a little bit like maybe a Kafka book where you don't know the crime you're charged with until the very end, you know, your death. But nevertheless, we'll find that out in the next slide. But out of that, the sense that to be the person God wants me to be, to do the best I can do in whatever setting it may be, and to respect other people. And I think out of that, those senses, honor other people. In business, I think it's part of our task, John, to help bring out the best in other people, not the worst. You've seen cultures in a lot of companies. Cultures are always set at the top of the company. And the culture of bringing out the best in other people instead of the worst in other people is one of the things that seemed to me most useful. Several of y'all, Jim, Peter, and others in this room have a long relationship in the real estate business, and you all know this is a white boy business and always has been. So one of the things I tried to do at Trammell Crow Company was to diversify our workforce with affirmative action policies in behalf of women, in behalf of ethnic minorities in the business, and those kinds of opportunities to be much more inclusive in business. And that, for me, stems from my faith. I think I also learned, perhaps I always knew this, that you can learn from anyone, can't you? I've never met a person I couldn't learn something from. So I think this is the beginning of respect for ourselves starts with respect for others. And I remember we used to interview several years running at Trammell Crow Company. We were the largest hirers of Harvard MBAs, Stanford MBAs, Wharton, Northwestern MBAs. Probably why we got in trouble later, but that's another story. But one thing I would always do before we made an offer to somebody is go out and talk to the receptionist and ask, how did they treat you? Because it's one thing to when they interview me, but how do they treat the receptionist? That became a mantra for us at Crow. So I think in all of this, we can learn from every person that we meet in our own company, the customers, the business people that we deal with. And I think in this age of celebrity CEOs and some of the frauds and scams that we've all seen, that it reminds me that kind of a beginning point and ending point for these tensions is to have a high degree of humility, if you will. Ariel, I'm trying to understand history, read through all of Ariel and Will Durant's history books, and they wrote a small book at the end about all they'd learned from studying history and teaching it all their lives, and they said that history is a long, long road, and its most important lesson is modesty. And I think modesty is lacking in business in America today, and I think our faith would tend, if we look in our own hearts first and then out, would tend to bring about modesty. Out of this, in the company, is, I think, again, this setting the tone from the top is about ethics. And as you all know, ethics can't, you can have ethics classes and all of that. They do it at Stanford Business School, and just as many frauds come out of there as come out of anywhere else. So it has to be set in action in the moment while you are a leader inside the company. So I think that when we got in tough times, you know, we were on the cover of Fortune magazine. We were on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. We were the largest developer and manager of property in the world in the middle 80s. By the end of the 80s, we were in trouble and having to do a series of workouts. And I think the reason why Ken Leventhal helped us with the workout plan. And what he would say to lenders and others we were dealing with, he said, you know, the thing about Crow is they don't lie, cheat, and steal. Well, you know, we thought we had these brilliant guys. But in the end, we were able to work out of our problems because people said of us, not because we said it, they don't lie, cheat, or steal. So they were willing to work with us. So I think those ethical standards are at the core of this lived out life of faith in the workplace. Finally, on this point of a person to be, there's a little book I read a long time ago that made a big impact on me. The British economist Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, you know, wrote another little book called Guide for the Perplexed. And he says there's two kind of problems. He says there's convergent problems and divergent problems. He said, convergent problems are those you study and you get narrow, and you know, you get a solution. Aha! You know, Peter, you're an engineer, so you solve that problem. And then he said, there's divergent problems. The more you study, the bigger they are, the more complex, the more mysterious, the larger they get. And those are divergent problems. And he said, all great problems are divergent problems. So I think, again, for me, it's grappling and wrestling with the divergent problems are the ones that I've enjoyed the most and learned the most from. So the search for a person to be, I think if I had to sum it up in the end, it would be out of Hebrews chapter 10, draw near to God. Draw near to God. And then out of Paul's teachings in Ephesians, move in the direction of the image of Christ in terms of your habits. So I think for me, that's kind of the takeaway for striving for a person to be. The search for others to love. After the JFK incident, I've been family, four boys, and an adopted girl. And by the way, that's a way to do a big genetic upgrade is to adopt. And so I'd spent all my time working, traveling, and all of that. And I decided out of that I needed to invest much more in my family and with my kids. So I took up hunting and fishing, which I'd never done as a kid. And then whitewater rafting trips and skiing and travel and all of that. And my three youngest sons were going to St. Mark's. I was on the board at St. Mark's. And so number four son took the test at St. Mark's. And I got a call from the headmaster saying he failed the test. I said, that's impossible. There's something wrong with the test, of course. And so would you have him retake it? So they had him retake it, and he did worse the second time. So what we discovered was that this was a son with serious learning disabilities. We learned later he had narcolepsy. He had a host of these kinds of problems. And so he kind of, you know, went from school to school and special schools. And finally, in an act of great fatherly wisdom, I sent him to a private boarding school in Connecticut for a year, which specialized in these kinds of special needs kids. That's when he started doing drugs. So great education he got there. So I wind up, he's handed a diploma at Winston out here, you know, the special ed school. He doesn't really graduate. And probably goes to four different colleges. As far as I can tell, he never showed up for a single class. So I'm constantly, you know, in this set of issues with him. Well, eventually you can imagine what happens, and that is he turns to heroin, becomes a heroin addict. We go through, you know, various treatment centers and programs and engagements. He relapses, and eventually he's on the street here in Dallas as a homeless person. I wish they'd had the bridge then. He might have been in better care. But out of this came the most extraordinary set of relationships between him and me. I had to go in one time into a heroin den in L.A. He was supposedly going to filmmaking school out there, and actually take him out and fly to Florida to put him into a treatment program out there. But over the course of this, he's now in his mid-30s. He's married. He's married to a recovering heroin addict like him, and they have two fantastic children. But what I learned is that the search for others to love always involves a struggle. And I have learned more from Victor than I have from anyone else in the whole world. I've learned, excuse me, I'm sorry to get emotional about this, but and we're the best of friends. We've sat there knee to knee in these counseling programs, you know, and treatment centers. And I'll never forget that at one time he said to me, Dad, thank you for sticking with me. He said, you know, what I needed is not a judge, not a father, but a friend. And you've been that friend to me. So I think the search for others to love somehow is to find in all of the messes and problems and issues of our life is a friend. And be a friend. So, the search for work to do. It's kind of the, I don't know about you all, but I've worked all my life. I probably started working at 8 or 9, and I would say close to a workaholic. But who am I after this incident at JFK Airport? You know, am I just my work? Am I my resume? Am I my bio? You know, am I my upward mobility aspirations? You know, is that who I am? Am I anything without that? So I had to go through that period, and it was an extraordinarily liberating sense to go through that I'm not just my job, or I'm not just my title, or I'm not just my income, or my house, or whatever. Now, on the other hand, work is extraordinarily noble and valuable. I frequently, as probably many of you all do, have young people come to me, and they say, well, I don't want to go into business. I want to go into ministry. I feel called into ministry, and I don't want to be tarnished by the workplace. You know, if you call that calling, so maybe it's wrong number. You know, you're called to do good work. I remember being struck from the book of Genesis. I thought work was a curse. I didn't realize that Adam and Eve were actually working in the garden before the fall. It just got harder after that. So they were called to work, and you know, you're the John Eane pastor and scholar, but in John chapter 5, where Jesus says, my Father is working still, and I am working too. I mean, I think that's a striking, you know, God's work goes on directly, and it goes on through us. So there's a lot of nobility in work, and yet, as John pointed out, the tensions are there, the tension between, he mentioned competition, the tensions between competition and some other kind of concern for people, and yet the necessity to be accountable to customers and to other stakeholders such as shareholders. Constant balancing of all of these interests over my experience in business. And how do you think about success and rewards and who gets paid and who gets paid what? When I first came to Dallas, Henry, you will know this because you're probably on the board of some of these companies. Or Kerry, you would know this. The CEO of, let's say, Texas Utilities in those days made the average of 40 times the average worker at Texas Industries or Texas Utilities. Today, as you all know, that ratio has gone to more than 400 times what the average worker. So we have, all of us have lived in and participated in this extraordinary sort of CEO celebrity culture that's gone on. And I'm on the compensation committee of several publicly held companies. They probably wish I weren't there. But I think that's a conflict with our faith. Like, who really is entitled? And the sort of libertarian view that prevails in Dallas among so many people. They may be Christians, but in fact they're libertarians. Because they believe they made it all themselves. You know, the Horatio, I did it myself. There's no respect for their family, their friends, the schools, public education, governmental services, laws that have gone on. So I think our culture is working against a biblical view about faith in the workplace today. And I believe that compensation systems are moral documents. And all of us involved in that have to take a view towards all of the people who are involved. The tension between empowerment and control systems. Which is more important, to empower people or to control? You know, you've heard the old adage, you can expect what you inspect and all of that. I heard on the other side that the principal strategy at Trammell Crow Company was best people. And let's try to recruit and support best people. That's how we were lucky enough to get Jim. Now, I should have had more controls in place because you don't know what somebody's character is until tough times. And in tough times, that's when you find out what people are made of. And so, which risk do you want to bear? I think that's because my experience in business is all of these things are matters of trade-off. And if you trade them off in a way that is responsive to the call of the Gospels and the ethics that are taught there, I think that's about the best you can do. And you're still going to make mistakes, as I did in that respect. And then in the company, defining the rules of the company. What are the rules of the game here? I mentioned before someone was able to say about us, they don't lie, cheat, or steal. We didn't pay bribes. We didn't set up people with girls to get business, for example. So many of our competitors did all over the country. So we didn't do business in New Orleans ever because you had to pay bribes. Now, it was disguised. You know, you hire a certain lawyer and an engineer and, you know, you overpay them and, you know, they're going to go pay off the right people. But I think what it did was set a tone in the company that we don't do business that way. The first time a sexual harassment issue came up, and I think it was kind of a hijinks kind of a thing within the company, but I fired the guy on the spot for any form of sexual harassment. And it's interesting, it set the tone. We never had another issue of it as far as I knew, because if a leader will set the tone on those kinds of issues, then I think you will have a much more likely to have a high standards within your company. So again, I know I could go on, but won't. But I think the question of how to be a witness in a pluralistic workforce that we have in Dallas and in the world today is a tough one, because if you wear out on your sleeve too much, I'm a Christian businessman. You try to, in essence, coerce people into Bible studies at the workplace. You know, I never believed that was useful. It is how you walked and how you talked. They saw an example in you or they didn't. And when people would come to me, like a lot of brokers knowing that I was a Christian believer, would come and they would want to say, can we say a prayer before we have this meeting? Man, I put my hand on my pocketbook. You know, you knew a real hustle was coming and somebody would use that. So my experience was, and I had to struggle with that. How overt should you be? How covert should you be? And I think that's a tension everybody has to work out. As John said, in 1994, I'd been CEO of Trammell Crow Company for 17 years, and I stepped aside, became chairman of the board, working half-time, and started Foundation for Community Empowerment. And again, this came out of the Bible study that I, as a spiritual discipline, I tried to read through the entire Bible every other year, and then some topical study in between. And as I did that over those years, I came to a very clear conviction that both the Old and New Testament documents clearly indicate God has a special concern for the poor. A special concern for the poor, the alien, the immigrant, the neglected, the orphans, the fatherless, and homeless, and others. I don't think it could be more clear. And that is what motivated me to step out of business. And yet, Dallas, Texas, you hope people will return your phone call. So they'll return your phone call if you're Don Williams, chairman of Trammell Crow, a lot faster than you're Don Williams do-gooder. So I tried to keep one step in each camp there in order to advance the work that we've done. And it's been a remarkable study, as Larry and others in this room know, the privilege you have to work with the poor. What you can learn from them. And I went in, CEO, I'm CEO of Trammell Crow Company here, and had to learn the hard lesson that you start with building a relationship. You start with listening. Start with respect. Start with having dinner in each other's home. And then from there, you can go on to do good work. And the model of Dallas is different. It's a noblesse oblige with the rich whites, essentially giving the crumbs off the table, having some kind of voyeur experience down in South Dallas, and, take a turkey to a poor kid at Thanksgiving, one of those deals. So we're not trusted. We're not trusted in low-income neighborhoods for good reason. And so I think a part of the work of the church over time, and all of us as believers, is to overcome by action, by relationships, by friendship, by mutuality, some of those kinds of conditions that we ourselves have created. So I think for me, John, the end is of this is life for me is under this sacred canopy. I mean, I love the atheists because they force you to talk real about all of this, don't you, and examine that. But life for me is under this sacred canopy and living with the struggles, living within the struggles, living within the issues and questions of our lives. And in the end, I think it's the biblical notion of work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So, Jamie, you can now correct the record here.
Good afternoon to everybody, and thank you, John, for a wonderful conversation. I was flying back to Dallas, sitting next to a rather large man. We got to talking. This always happens when you try to grade papers and you're a Bible teacher on a plane. People can't resist the urge to look over. It's not helped when you are reading books written by your colleagues with such titles as Naked Faith. So that's Elaine Heath. Our colleague Elaine Heath has a new book called Naked Faith. Anyway, we got to talking about our jobs, and turns out that he was on his way back from a business trip. I asked him more about it. He said, well, I've been 3 days up here in the Northeast. I'm going to go home. I'm going to unpack my bags, do the laundry, repack my bags, and I got to fly back out tomorrow. So tonight I get to spend some time with my 2-year-old daughter and my wife, who's pregnant with our second child. In the middle of the conversation, I noticed him taking some kind of pill. So we talked, and apparently he had heart trouble. Very large man, mid-30s maybe. So I said to him, wow, when do you find time to take care of yourself and exercise? And he said, oh, what are you talking about? I don't have time for that. He said, I've got to live this kind of life. You have to have money to have the finer things. Okay, so the flight continues, and I notice my colleague get up and disappear for quite a while. Next thing I hear over the loudspeaker, is there a doctor on the plane? Eventually, my colleague makes his way back to the seat, and we hear we're going to have an early landing to get him some help. So I did the only thing I know to do, and that is to say, is there anything I can do to help you? And he said, yes, pray. That I can do. That I did. But it occurs to me that there might be other helpful things we can do, and that is have conversations like this about who we are, what does it mean to be human, and how do we get ourselves into these situations, locked into these situations. I want to tell you that Perkins is a great place for helping people think through these and other crucial life issues. And I want to tell you what you won't find For those of you who aren't familiar with Perkins, let me fill you in on what you won't find here. You won't find banal, platitudinous generalizations about people or moralistic, simplistic generalizations about faith. All business people have questionable morals. Money is bad. Money is good. Wealth is bad. Wealth is good. God especially favors the rich. God especially favors the poor. God hates the rich. God hates the poor. To be Christian, you have to be Republican. To be Christian, you have to be Democrat. To be Christian, you have to be Libertarian. And then my personal favorite as a Bible teacher here, well, the Bible says... Listen, the Bible says a lot of things. And so do Christians across the ages of all stripes. So at Perkins, we take both people and faith too seriously to countenance silly prattle about either one. Here's what you will find. Reflective, invigorating, relevant conversation with other thinking individuals. And why go it alone when it comes to subjects that matter the most? So what happens when we draw upon reason, experience, sacred texts, and the wisdom, not to mention the failings, of the Christian community over the past 2,000 years, including today? You'll find on your table an outline to this talk so that you can either write your grocery list or wonder when I'm going to stop talking, this kind of thing. What I want to do then, because you asked a Bible teacher to come and be part of this, so we got to dig into some Bibles. It just has to be done. So I want to spend a few minutes playing with the Gospel of Luke. And here's what I want to do. I'm going to read it out loud. And I want you, here's your job, here's your assignment. Okay? And I even made it 1.5 spaces so you could circle or scribble or whatever. So if you're so moved, do so. So I want to know, especially in light of what Dawn has just shared, I want to know what questions and observations the passage raises for you. This is the way I usually ask this question to my students. What strikes you, comforts you, enrages you, perplexes you, inspires you? Think, emote, opine. So I want to start then with this parable in Luke. It goes like this, from Luke 12, 16 to 34. Then he, that being Jesus, told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, what should I do? For I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God. He said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? If then you aren't able to do so small a thing as that, why do you worry about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And don't keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink. And don't keep worrying. For it is the nations of the world that strive after all these things. Your Father knows you need them. Instead, strive for his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Don't be afraid, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Make purses for yourselves that do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Okay, so I'm a teacher, so this is the part where you get to kind of dialogue and get in here. I'm not going to be able to stand it if I don't hear some voices out here from the crowd. So hearing that passage and given our particular topic for today, not every topic that we could ever talk about with this passage, but given our subject today, what kinds of questions or observations emerge?
What's all business going to do is give thought to tomorrow. I mean, that's what business is, giving thought to tomorrow.
Okay, so there's already an inherent tension in the text raises that how can you, you wouldn't be a business person if you didn't give thought to tomorrow, okay? Yes?
If we're not careful, we can think that the fruits of business are all ours and all about us instead of a means to an end.
Okay. Good. No, I want to hear what you all have to say.
Me, with my struggle with this is it seems to be encompassed in the parable of the talents.
Okay, good. So remind us briefly in the parable of
the
talents.
Where the master leaves and makes different amounts of talents to his servants. And they do different things. And he comes back and rewards the one that was most productive and the one who was good.
Yeah, and not only that, the downside of the parable. Not only does he reward the guy who actually went out and did something and built, grew it, but even more scary, I was thinking about that one. There's a lot of biblical passages. I don't know y'all well enough to put some of those biblical passages on there. The downside of the parable is the guy who was given something and just buried it, did nothing with it because he feared the wrath of the one who gave it to him. He did nothing. He's actually the one who suffers judgment for actually doing nothing with what he was given. Okay? Yes.
It's interesting, and you helped the way you read it, how the author, when he is dealing with just a fully human businessman, uses I. And it's interesting that the author obviously took time when describing the one who's fully divine and the one who has both natures at the same time. It's all you. There's no I.
Which
speaks to God's comment about his second desire.
Yeah, exactly. Others to love. Just like that. And actually, Dawn and I didn't. We had a conversation. First of all, I hope that my guy. I didn't know you were going to tell the story about the airport. And all right this minute, I am praying for my airplane partner right now that maybe that airplane event for him also stopped him up to ask the kinds of questions you were forced to ask under that. So it's beautiful blessing to me to hear that story. But yes, and I try to emphasize that, but the text itself really emphasizes this I, my, which Dawn got at. Really, I mean, this guy is a quintessential self-made man, which Dawn is questioning whether that exists today. Yes?
Well, I have a theory that money is not evil or bad.
Mm-hmm.
We build churches, we build schools.
Right.
We do a lot for the poor. We feed them.
Exactly.
We clothe them. We do a lot of things. And if money itself is evil, that's not it. But it's, if you have a talent to do something and make money and share it, that's good. And I think that's, you can have all the poor people in the world, who are they going to help?
Right.
Where are you going to get the help?
Good. Good. And this raises a host of wonderful conversations. I want to point out two things on this. I've listed at the end of this because I'm hoping what will happen is not only will you take these things personally, these questions personally, these texts personally, but with any luck, you'll also go out to your own communities, maybe not the workplace itself, but your churches, your friends, gather around and have deeper, longer conversations about these tensions and learn from one another. So I've listed some primary passages, in other words, some texts to get you started from the New Testament, if you are so inclined, with a little bit of an annotated word on what the texts are kind of about. And also a few books. One of them is Wealth as Peril and Obligation, the New Testament on Possessions. And exactly, she's very helpful in terms of making your exact.
We're going to try to use this microphone because we want everybody to hear your questions. If you have a question, raise your hand or stand up. Paul's trying to adjust the sound. Yes?
I would just add to the reading list Paul Escamilla's book, Longing for Enough and a Culture of More.
Exactly. Thank you.
And the Cokesbury Bookstore is exactly. On the bottom floor of Selectman Hall right next door, if you
and
would
you,
like
I bet
to stop
you can
by.
Even get a signature on the book if you buy it quickly.
He also is a sound man today.
Tolstoy's story, How Much Land Is Enough?
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. How much land does a man need?
Mine is a comment, Don. Where is the challenge that I selfishly enjoyed so much and would like others to at least have the benefit of that says, I've seen a lot in the discovery in my work in Southern Dallas, and I haven't seen anything that we cannot solve. Pardon the double negative there, but I loved it, and I miss it. Can we solve it?
Short answer is yes. We lack the will. I mean, as an example, let me just give you one illustration of the problem Albert's talking about. You all know more or less half the population of Dallas lives in the southern sector and half in the northern sector. And it's literally a tale of two cities in terms of economic development, home values, jobs, homelessness, joblessness, and so on. And when I started working on this problem of economic development in the southern sector, and Albert's business is over there, I mean, he's a major employer, so it's an important business in the community. What I found is it is on nobody's radar screen in Dallas. I mean, the Greater Dallas Chamber, who's supposed to be looking out for the southern sector, doesn't bother to do that when there's corporate relocations or other issues that come up. I, several times, being from the real estate business, know that real estate brokers have never even been over there. I mean, except unless they're, you know, driving to their lake house in Athens or something or other and just hope they don't have a flat tire or run out of gas. And so I would take busloads of brokers on tours in the southern sector, and they really could not believe the wonderful neighborhoods, the business parks, the land, the amount of opportunity that was available. So I think, Albert, you really raised an even larger issue, and that is in a city like Dallas, how do you change a stale old conversation? You know, we, they, rich, poor, black, white, brown, black, public schools versus all the rest. I mean, how do you change that conversation? And the only thing I know out of our experience in the last 5 years trying to help transform Dallas Independent School District is that we all have to sort of agree on a mission. The big problem we had with DISD was that there were a lot more people focused about adult issues and jobs, contracts, and vending relations with DISD than about how the children performed academically, since they were all poor children of color. That's who's in DISD. And then secondly, I think the question is, what informs a conversation? And what we learned in the Dallas Achieves Commission process was that if you're going to change a conversation in a city like Dallas, because we can probably, all of us in this room can probably finish each other's lines on nearly everything, is you've got to have research and best practice data. So when an issue comes up, you can say, that's a great issue. You know, Peter, what you think about education or curriculum, or Kerry, what you think about curriculum, or Don or Brad or whoever, let's see what the research shows. What do high-performing school districts do? So I think that's what we have not done in Dallas, Albert, is to demonstrate the opportunity side the potential for the whole community. We've just not done a good job communicating that. Kind of gave a long-winded answer to a good question. Sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you suggest that we actually do communicate?
Well, first people have to go there, don't they? You know, the youth group at most of the churches here, if they want an inner-city experience, they go to Chicago, south side of Chicago, or they go to New Orleans, you know, post-Katrina or whatever. And the youth groups in most of the churches in Dallas have never been over there. Now, King of Glory Lutheran Church is a great best practice of this, where the kids, the church had essentially no interest in sort of social justice issues, if you will. The kids, we helped set up where the kids use their summer camp down to Park South YMCA in South Dallas with other kids. In other words, partnerships with, not handouts to, but handshakes, not handouts. They came back on fire. They spent 2 weeks down there working with other young people of color in the community. They came back to their church out at LBJ and Hillcrest on fire. Got the adults on fire. So in a real sense, we're being led by the children out of this wilderness, if you will. And now King of Glory Lutheran has gotten major commitments and involved people of all ages and in the southern sector. So somebody's got to go there, the older folk or the younger folk, and then we've got to listen and learn and the mutual respect issues I said before. Do you agree with that, Albert, or do you have some other? Jamie, do you have a passage on that?
We have covenanted with you, and I apologize because I know some of you had questions, to end right at 1:30. Don, can you stay around a few minutes?
Sure.
I didn't ask you that before. Jamie, they're gonna stay around just a few more minutes. If you would like to engage them personally, please do. But I do want to be faithful to the time we agreed. Before you walk out, if you will take out your PDA device, on Tuesday, January 19th, we are going to have another faith and business event in this space. Please put that on your calendar. Maureen Dickey has agreed to be our business community speaker. County Commissioner, right? Is that? She's County Commissioner, right? Many of you know her. She will be. And then we have a faculty member who, unfortunately, Friday before, he did not say yes to me, but I think we've got him on the hook. So, but I don't want to tell you his name. Out of respect for him. But please put that on your calendar. Also, if you would like to make sure you get the invitation to that on your table, if you will hold that up, please. If you would fill that out, we are doing email invitations to these events, and we want you to please make sure you bring your friends. We would like to have them here as well. One other date to put on your calendar, Friday, February 12th, Perkins will be hosting a public life, private faith lecture with Dr. Ron C. White, who wrote the biography of Lincoln, A. Lincoln. Many of you read that. That will be an event down at the Crescent Hotel. You will be hearing more information. If you'd like more information, please let me know. Let's say again thank you to Don and to James. And thank you all for being here.